What the Health with George Bertineau on FUBAR Radio.
Good morning and welcome to What the Health with me, George Bertineau. A little bit about myself. I'm an online coach helping everyday people make everyday better decisions. I'm helping people achieve weight loss, mindset changes, lifestyle shifts, and much, much more. I have a BSc in sports rehabilitation, and I've worked in professional sport for over 5 years. I've been a health and fitness expert for over a decade, and I'm here to talk to you about the world of health and fitness, supporting you whilst you navigate through a minefield of information on the internet and a world full of rubbish and deception. Each week I'll be joined by a range of guests to dissect the latest fitness trends, separating facts from myths, and advising you on achieving your health and fitness goals the correct and healthiest way possible. This week on Mythbusters, I'm going to be joined by Giles Yeo, who is Professor of Molecular Neuroendocrinology at the University of Cambridge and Honorary President of the British Dietetic Association. Giles, good morning. Welcome. How are you?
Good morning. Quite a mouthful. But thank you so much for having me on.
No worries. No, thank you for joining us. And yeah, quite the mouthful, but obviously very well earned and, respected. So what does obesity mean?
See, that's the $64 million question. I think that for the longest time, it was just down to the BMI scale. And I think most of us now realize that that is flawed. At the population level, BMI is perfectly fine to actually associate it with health. So I think that BMI is just a number, literally.
Yeah.
But I think obesity is carrying too much fat that it begins to influence your health. So by that definition, then obesity is a disease and we need to take care of it. The tricky question to ask is how much is too much fat?
Okay, so, and we're not just talking external fat, we're also talking visceral fats, which we can't actually see, right? So let's go, I mean, we quickly spoke a moment ago about BMI. So you feel that the BMI kind of chart and scale needs to change? Yeah?
I don't think it needs to change.
Okay.
I think it needs to be given in context.
Okay.
So because I think that, you know, whenever I speak to healthcare professionals, doctors, nurses, you know, dietitians, whatever, when they look at a human being in front of them, they need to treat the human being in front of them.
Mm.
So, you know, weighing, yes, it's one of the numbers that we know. I don't think you need to change the scale. I think it needs to be there. I think that just needs to be an additional... I mean, perfectly, if we could measure exactly how much fat you have on you, including visceral, wonderful. That's difficult to do, at least at scale.
Mm-hmm.
So I just think that you need to treat the person in front of you, including how sick they are, how not, are they out of breath? There are a whole lot of other things that you can do in addition to just looking at the BMI.
Okay. Well, that's going to take us obviously on to our main topic of today, which is weight loss injections. So they're pretty rife at the moment. They're out there. Mm-hmm. There's 101, well, not 101 options, but there's a few options out there. Mounjaro, Ozempic, Wegovy. How do these weight loss injections actually work?
So the current class we're talking about, so all the names you've just mentioned, are all modified versions of naturally occurring hormones in us that are produced by our gut. So every mouthful of food we eat, as it goes down our throat, into our stomach and out the other side, hormones are released.
Yeah.
Okay. And we know of over 20 different gut hormones that are released. Most of them make you feel fuller.
Mm-hmm.
18 of them make you feel fuller.
Okay.
And these drugs are based on two of them. They're based on GLP-1, which is what Ozempic and Wegovy are based on.
Yes.
And they are based on GLP-1 and GIP, which is the second one, which is what Mounjaro is based on.
Okay. And what would you say the biggest misconception about these jabs are at the moment?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I think the biggest misconception is that if you're taking the jabs, you're cheating. And I know a lot of people that do it. This is, oh, you should be doing it naturally. Well, I don't know what naturally actually really means you in this setting, because all we're doing with these jabs, there are downsides to it as well, obviously, but all we're doing with these jabs are changing either one or two hormone levels in your blood, effectively. That's all we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And by doing that, we're changing feeding behavior. So in very many ways, these are not amphetamines. They're not small molecules. Mm-hmm. You can't get addicted to them, you know. And so all you're doing is changing naturally occurring hormones within you just a little bit. Well, not just a little bit, quite a lot.
Yeah.
Therefore, making you feel fuller. You feel fuller, you eat less. You eat less, you lose weight.
Yeah, okay. Right, so saying that, if we're incorporating, because I'm hearing a lot at the moment about, obviously, weight loss injections, and as a coach, I've had clients that have taken it and they've wanted to learn the habits as well, because obviously the problem is post-injection, right? So let's say you don't pick up these habits and then you've suppressed your GLP-1 and you, was it your GP?
Increased it, not suppressed.
You're increasing it so that your hunger levels are decreased. What happens when you stop taking it and your hunger level goes back to normal and then you have your habits haven't changed?
So these are drugs. They're drugs. They're powerful drugs and they're drugs. So like all drugs, they only work when you're taking them.
Mm-hmm.
So the moment you stop, and your hormone levels come back down to what they were prior to the injections.
And do they come back?
They
to
will
normal?
Come back
oh,
down.
They do.
They don't stay up. Okay. They'll come back down because they're produced internally from the gut.
Mm-hmm.
So natural levels. And so what you're doing is you're just increasing them using these injections. The moment they come back down, your feeding behavior will go back to what it was if you haven't changed anything.
Okay. Would it potentially become worse? So you become more hungry?
That's an interesting question. I don't know if enough people have taken it for us to unequivocally answer that question. From first principles, just in terms of from the biology of the system, unlikely, but we have to
unsure.
See. We have to see. We have to see.
Because it's all very new, isn't it?
It is all very new.
And it's all, you know, it's like with everything, the fads, the gimmicks, you know, there used to be Slimming World, there used to be the Shake Diet, every Atkins Diet, everyone's kind of done everything. It's like, you know, what haven't you tried? And you know, so... We again spoke moments before the show started about how I would suggest it to someone who is morbidly obese.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so if your health is at risk, if you are struggling to move, you are in lots of joint pain, you can't mentally and physically stop yourself from consuming too much food, and you maybe have overeating syndrome, or you maybe overeat and you just stuff yourself, that is someone that I would probably recommend it to. Where is your stance on that?
My stance on that is just the term morbidly obese, because I'm not, I guess it means that obesity, but serious.
Yeah, so where your health is at risk.
But I think that any obesity, the definition that I'm working with, is that any obesity means your health is not only at risk, you are already in poor health. So in other words, if you just happen to be heavier, but are metabolically perfectly in health,
work out, kind of do a bit of cardio from time to time, that isn't just going to the fridge, because that is cardio for me.
Exactly.
To the fridge.
So resistance training is the
exactly
hot
heavy door. You know,
so I think that we need to just go away just from the weight. So the moment it influences your health, and there are any number of measures, blood pressure, cholesterol levels, what have you, glucose levels, then I think you should qualify for taking the drug.
Okay.
Now, this means that actually there are going to be some people who are not as heavy as you might imagine. You're going, well, this person is not that large. Yeah. Why should he or she be on a drug? Versus, well, hang on a second. This person is actually quite large. Why isn't he or she already on the drug? So I think if we think about it in that way, to my mind, it makes more sense.
Okay. And then it comes down to obviously getting them through the system, because it's not as easy to just, because people right now, they're buying them online from online pharmacies. They aren't getting regulated. People are just going, oh, you filled out a questionnaire, tick tick tick, that'll do, thanks for the payment, shipping it out. And like we said, people are just going from 0 to 100. And that's why I asked earlier about when the level of GLP-1 drops back to normality, is there potentially going to be increased hunger? And then, you know, when we are hungry and we have bad habits, and we were larger, we struggle to then regulate what we want to do, and we don't really want to exercise, so we eat more and more and more, and we put all the weight back on, potentially. Obviously, this is hypothetical.
And probably more. Yeah.
And then you're in Schitt's Creek.
So I think a couple of things. First of all, this is an odd situation we're in which we clearly live in a country with an NHS.
Mm-hmm.
There are probably hundreds of thousands. I last heard nearly a million. Let's call it high hundreds of thousands of people in this country, in the UK, that are on these drugs.
Mm.
Do you know how many people are getting it on prescription for obesity?
Let's go with 2.6%.
Pretty close. 30,000 people of those hundreds of thousands. But I would say probably about 5%.
Yeah, okay.
Which is weird. Mm. Okay, so first of all, it's a drug that we all know the name of. How many other drugs does anybody, bar a doctor, know the name of? Aside from Brufen.
you
know, or something like that. So it's clearly out there, but yet these drugs are approved by the NHS and people are not getting it. And then we can debate why that's not the situation, but that's that. So yes, you're right. The vast majority of people are getting it privately.
Yeah.
And there are negatives to that. And the negatives is that we need to make sure that only the right people get it. You might ask me what the right person is, because these drugs are so these drugs are good because they're powerful and they work and they're relatively safe.
And people know about them because of social media.
Exactly. Do you know why they're bad? Because they're powerful and they work for everyone, pretty much. Whether or not you're 350 pounds looking to lose 100, or whether or not you're a 16-year-old girl who's 75 pounds.
Yeah.
They will work whatever your starting weight. Mm-hmm. So only people who are ill, who need the drug, should get the drug.
Yes, I totally agree. Totally agree. And I guess that goes back onto what we said before. You need to cut. There has to be some more criteria. It can't just be, I want to look better this summer. Well, in 12 weeks, you could probably lose 12 kilos if you incorporate a calorie deficit, 4, 5, maybe 6 gym sessions a week, and some walking every day. You put all three of those together, you can lose a kilo a week, and you can absolutely smash anything.
All of that is fine, but
there's always a but.
The calorie deficit is
the hard part.
Now, it's easier for some people than others, but for some other people, it is for internal biological reasons very, very difficult.
Well, I was probably a gluttonous medieval king in a previous life who used to eat my boar every day of the week. I can
like an asterisk and obelisk.
Honestly, if I'm not careful, I could consume 5, 6, 7, 10,000 calories a day, but not of clean food. And I'm okay admitting that as a coach, because I live in the real world. I understand life is about balance and lifestyle. And I train hard. I do my steps. I do my calorie deficit. But if I want to have a week where I maintain or I put on half a kilo of water, I'm okay with that.
So I think the other myth about these drugs, there probably are two of them, but the other big myth is that it will make you healthier. Now, what these drugs will do is it will make you lose weight. Undoubtedly.
But weight isn't always fat.
It's not only does weight isn't only fat, but you can also lose weight and still have a crappy diet.
Oh, yeah.
And so these drugs, and this is the thing, do not improve your diet. So if you were a health person anyway, but just eating too much and throw away heavier, then these drugs will probably do their job without anything else.
Yeah, yeah.
But the vast majority of people don't have the best diets. And so if you got a diet of chips and Oreos, okay, right? All this drug will do,
tasty as well.
All these drugs will do is make you eat less
of the chips and Oreos.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. And so, and that is, yes, you will lose weight because you are going into a calorie deficit of chips and Oreos.
Yes.
But you know, it has nothing to do with your protein, your fiber, your micronutrient contents. So these drugs need to be prescribed.
Yes.
But with some kind of dietary intervention so that when the drugs do stop, they won't stop for all. We can get to that maybe. Mm-hmm. But if they do stop, you need to have taken the opportunity when you're on those drugs and therefore the hunger has gone away to try and do the work, the hard miles to improve your diet.
Mm. Okay. One of the final questions, what are some of the side effects that you can see happening or are occurring potentially?
So the common ones, and these are the ones that are well reported, particularly and emerge from the trials, all affect your gastrointestinal tract.
Okay.
Because these are gut hormones. And, okay, put very, very simply, the role of gut hormones is to control the flow of food from here to out the other side.
Yes.
Okay. So what all of the common, relatively common side effects are affects this. Okay, so in other words, either out the front end,
Yes.
Okay.
Okay.
Feeling nauseous or out the back end. Okay. Either too fast or too slow.
Too slow.
Because because it depends on how sensitive you are. It depends on what you were eating to begin with. Mm. And it depends on what your natural hormones were like, responsiveness to begin with. So these are the common side effects of these drugs.
Okay, so they're the things that people need to be aware of.
You'll know it. I think if you are more... So the thing about this hormones, the natural biological role of this hormones, particularly out the front end, is actually to trigger vomiting if you are in a situation in which you need to expel. So if you've had a bad prawn, and then suddenly, you know, we've all had food poisoning and we've run explosively to the loo.
Yes, that uncontrollably.
Because the hormones have naturally just spiked to go. Ah, it's a natural. So if you happen to be, we know people that are a little bit too pukey, and so if you are a bit sensitive to it and take it, you are likely to have that particular side effect.
Okay, right. Giles, thank you so much for your time. I could talk to you all day about this because it's such an interesting topic. But where can people and the listeners find you? On social media or anything like that?
They can get me on social media. Just if you look for me, I got a weird enough name. Either I'm a Devonian dairy farmer or I've got a weird name, which is so Giles Yeo. So at Giles Yeo and pretty much all my handles, Instagram in particular, which I have an X, are my two things. At Giles Yeo, you can come find me.
Amazing. Thank you so much for your time. You have a great rest of your day. I'll speak to you soon.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Right, guys, coming up after the short break, I'll be joined by Anya Culling, who is an elite marathon runner.
Fubar Radio. That Money Show with Gabriel Nussbaum on Fubar Radio.
Let's go back to the beginning. A mortgage advisor. What does a mortgage advisor do?
So, the main purpose of a mortgage advisor is to help you to achieve the best possible mortgage solution on time and first time. Typically, in the modern day, it's somebody who's going to hold your hand through the full home buying process, liaising with solicitors, estate agents, helping with insurance, and being in your corner on your team to make sure you achieve that goal.
You're listening to Fubar Radio. Download our app now to listen to your favourite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored, and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all Fubar shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app. Just search for Fubar Radio on the Apple and Google App Stores. Yay! The Fubar Radio app. Get it today. Get it today.
When you notice something wrong, it tends to grow and eventually take over to the point you can't really think of anything else. If something in your body doesn't feel right, the thought it could be cancer can play on your mind. Tests could put your mind at rest. Finding out sooner is always better. Your NHS wants to see you. Contact your GP practice.
I was fine on this beach the other day. I didn't know the time of high tide changes, and I had no idea it could come in so fast. So I'm finding out the hard way. From this fella, the Coast Guard, who dropped in to get me out.
Ready!
Before you go to the coast, check the tide times online. In an emergency, call 999 and ask for the Coast Guard.
Access All Areas with Bobby Norris.
We are joined by Miss Safia. If I could produce you a salt, what is he like on paper? Sound like we're on Love Island.
Okay, on paper, my type has to have a good soul, good purpose and calm energy. I'm in my energy era where you've just got to come in and make me happy. I don't need you for anything. I want to find happiness and I need him to be kind.
Couple Goals with Sophie Kasai and Jordan Brooke.
Maura Higgins.
That's a Geordie Shaw thing.
Has scrubbed a shitty toilet with her ex-boyfriend's toothbrush. Why did she do this?
He's obviously done something very bad.
Do we know who he is? Does anybody know who he is?
No, but I mean, I don't think he'd want to know who he is.
No.
I think he'd probably go and hide in now, whoever that is.
Mate, if you're listening to this, go and buy a new toothbrush because you've still got the same one.
Get yourself to Turkey and get yourself some veneers because I can't imagine them teeth are going to last much longer.
No.
What the Health with Georges Bertineau, exclusively on FUBAR Radio.
This is What the Health on FUBAR Radio with me, Georges Bertineau. This week, I'm joined by Anya Culling, who is an elite marathon runner. Anya, hello, welcome, how are you?
Hi, Georges, thanks for having me. Yeah, I'm excited. I have the marathon on Sunday, so it's all I'm thinking about every minute of every day.
I bet it's your training has taken over your life over the past how many months?
I constantly train, but yeah. I've been very focused the last 2 months.
Okay, nice. So 2 months to the build-up of it, and you kind of dial it in, turn up the notch, ramp it up a little bit, or not a little bit, probably quite a lot. Your intensity goes quite high, and then I bet you're getting excited for it.
I am. Yeah, it's definitely a whole process of getting comfortable, feeling uncomfortable, which I enjoy. It's always, very daunting at the start of the marathon block, but by the end, I feel like I'm on a roll.
Amazing stuff. Right, so how did you first get into running? Give us the kind of story behind that.
Yeah, I have never been a runner all my life. All of my friends that run did it in school. They did it for like their club growing up. I never knew you could be a marathon runner or like do it as a job or anything. Mm-hmm. I did my first marathon in 2019 at London Marathon, and I ran a very respectable time of 4 hours and 34 minutes. Then I hated every moment of that, and it didn't spark my love for running. I didn't carry on running after that. It wasn't until lockdown when I think I lost my spark. I lost a lot of confidence, and I wanted something to do to push me to feel like I was achieving something. And I thought back to that first marathon I did, which was traumatizing, to be honest. But I remember how great it felt after, and so I just picked up running again, and I fell completely in love with it, and I haven't stopped since. And I've now knocked 2 hours off that marathon time, so my PB is now 2:34.
Which is incredible. Absolutely, like life-changing stuff, really. It's such a beautiful story, the way you kind of went from someone who didn't really do it. You know, you had people around you in your social circle who ran, to doing it, finding it grueling, and then just being like, actually, yeah, let's do this.
Yeah, that's exactly it. I think I learnt to find the joy in that gruelingness of it, and
a little bit sadistic as well.
Yeah. I've put myself in that hole, but then, after it, I have never felt like endorphins like it, and I still get that to this day, and it makes my entire day better, which makes my life better, and I've become a new person since that first marathon. I just have so much confidence and self-belief, which I've definitely taken from running. Just like, I achieve things that I never thought I could, and so I take that into everyday life and just like never limit myself now, which is...
You've grown as a person, not just physically but mentally as well, because it's a certain kind of mental toughness that you need to have to think, God, I'm halfway there, or an hour in the grand scheme of things is nothing of life, right?
Yeah.
But if you're doing something competitive, an hour is a long time of continuously doing something.
Yeah.
So 2 hours and 34 minutes is incredible for a marathon time, right? But it's also, in the grand scheme of things, doing sport is quite long. So you've got to have that mental toughness. So you've clearly kind of developed that, and you've been working on that as well.
Yeah, I think the marathon is majority mental rather than physical. It's always going to get tough, especially in that last 10 kilometers, and you really have to believe you've got it and embrace that pain and know you're stronger than it. And when you hit the wall, you're not just going to hit it, you're not going to like get through it, you're going to like smash it, you're going to climb over it, and let it propel you on.
So I'll go on to a couple of other things in a minute, but you've just mentioned the wall, the famous runner's wall. I've never actually asked this question before, so what does it feel like?
Yeah, it definitely happens, and I think you get it no matter how much training you've been in, whether you're running a 6-hour marathon or a world record time. Everyone hits that bit, just because we've never really ran that far in training. I think there's two walls. I think there's a psychological wall, which you've just got to be prepared for, and you've got to believe in yourself that you can push on. It's like that saying, when the going gets tough, the tough gets going. And that's when you really have to rally and push through it. And then the second wall is if you haven't fueled well enough, and that's when you really like are so depleted and there's basically no coming back from that. Like if you're dehydrated, you're haven't had enough carbs.
Yeah Okay, because they obviously offer fluids and gels, but I mean, having worked with athletes, I always just tell them, make sure you drink enough water with your gel, because that's a lot of condensed carbohydrate in one sitting, which makes people probably be sick and so on, because it's a lot to ingest, right?
Yeah. I think a lot of people struggle with gels, but I always get comments being like, I just can't find one I like. But the thing is, no one really likes them.
You're not really meant to like them, mate, is the sad truth.
Yeah, find one that's not going to make you throw up.
Yeah, exactly. Right, so last year you ran the London Marathon for the first time in the elite category. How did it feel crossing the finish line?
I was so scared to line up on the start line against some of my biggest inspirations. And I was like, I can't believe I'm like running with the elites.
That's
and
so cool, by
people
way.
Were saying to me like, no, you are one of the elites. You're not running with them. And I had to like overcome a lot of imposter syndrome, I think.
Self-doubt, yeah.
Yeah, because I was like, is this luck? How have I got here? And then I just thought to myself, I just need to enjoy this day because I've got myself in this position. Like, no one's done the training, I've done it. And so this is like the icing on top of the cake. And so many people unfortunately get injured and don't actually make it to that marathon start line. So once you're there, you've got to just show all your training. But I just remember like crying my eyes out, hugging my family. Like, it changed my life.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
And you say luck. I am a firm believer of we create our own luck. We put ourselves in the shop window. Though it's then about you who needs to perform at the right time.
That's so weird that you say that, because I've always said to my mum, like, I just think I'm a very lucky person.
You create your own luck, I think, personally.
Yeah, but. And I'm always just like, oh, let's just go for it, because, you know, I'm just lucky. Like, I just get good outcomes from things.
Yeah.
But I think that might be my, like, positive outlook as well, which, you know.
Positivity is a huge thing. You know, you can refer to yourself as a lucky egg, whatever you want to be, but I think, I personally think you create your own luck.
Yeah.
Because you put yourself in that position. If you don't do the work, do you get that opportunity?
Yeah, exactly.
Do you get seen? Well, you did the work. You might say it's lucky, but maybe you created that luck. Right, your training. So you said at the start of this conversation that about 2 months before you start to ramp it up and you train kind of all year round. Can you give us an insight into your training routine and, you know, how you kind of achieve the times that you do?
Yeah. So the times definitely came secondary to me. I think a lot of people now, because running's so popular, they've dived in.
So
they
popular.
See these like crazy times. They set huge expectations on themselves. It's like an echo chamber, the running world. You just look at people doing these crazy challenges and you're like, I need to do that.
With comparison is the thief of all joy, right?
That's it. Yeah. But because I didn't know about marathon running before, I genuinely just loved it, stuck at it and stayed consistent. And then the times came secondary. And I think you've got to go into it knowing like, this is going to change your life. This is a lifestyle change. And it's not like one marathon and done. The way you're going to see improvement is, you know, chipping away bit by bit.
But
I just stuck to it. I obviously have built up over time gradually. I've been doing it for like 5 or so years now. My training, I've done a lot. Like when I hit a PB of 2:34, I probably crossed the red line a little bit into overtraining.
Okay.
This one I've brought back to enjoy it because I didn't want to lose that love for the sport. I've still done a lot. I was averaging 140, 150 kilometers a week.
It's a lot.
So like almost 100 miles, at least 20 kilometers a day, a track session every week, which is like short, sharp intervals, a tempo session, which is longer reps, often with like a jog recovery, slightly closer to marathon pace, and then a big run at the weekend. My longest one was 38 kilometres.
Okay, wow, that's long.
Like, it's almost a marathon.
Yeah, basically. So for someone who obviously coaches people, do you have an S&C coach or do you have weight sessions as well? Because they're super important, but you know, not everyone does.
Yeah, so I'm lucky enough to have people helping me with that. I go to a guy, it's a place called The Running Room. His name's Adrian, and he's like runner specific.
Yeah, S&C running.
Great. Cool. It just like builds my foundations, and I tend to do that before I dive into this like 2 months block, just so that my body is ready for
strong,
that
resilient.
Increase in intensity.
Yeah, nice. Okay. So You last year you ran, obviously, your elite race, but you ran it alone.
Yeah.
How was that?
Yeah, so London Marathon, the elite women go off first, like half an hour before the elite men. So you basically do run it alone. I'm not fast enough to be like in the world record pack against like those crazy Kenyan Africans. Like, so I wasn't able to be with them. So I was like at the back of the elites. And that's really tough because all you can hear is like your own head. So that was definitely like a mental training session for me, but I've come out of it stronger and better because of it. It's all to like highlight the women in the sport more so they get the spotlight, because normally the cameras just show the men, but then it makes it a harder race for the women as well, because well this year I'm doing it with the masses, so I'm going to have a crowd of guys around me hopefully, which you know we can all spur each other on, and that's kind of what I love about running. It's the community and it's the helping each other, and you're not racing them, like you're all racing yourselves but together. And so this one's going to be more why I love running, whereas the last one just felt a lonely 42 kilometers in the streets of London.
That's a long time to be doing something that you're passionate about, but you've got the devil, you haven't even got the devil and the angel, have you? You've got two devils on your shoulder and it's they're talking to you the whole time. So what has been your proudest achievement so far?
I think I represented England at Copenhagen Marathon, where I set my PB, and that was just so crazy. I didn't want to tell anyone I was doing it because I kind of didn't believe it myself, and I told my mum, but I was like, like until the flights are booked we're not telling anyone. That was incredible. I was like, I'm doing this for my country. And I was able to give up my job after that. And I got a sponsor, and running became my life. And looking back, I'm just so proud of myself. And I think when it gets tough on Sunday, I know this is quite like, big headed, but I'll think back to 2019 Anya and be like, I'm inspired by her. And
look
like,
at me now.
Yeah. And I think that will really help me. Yeah, crying into my mum and my brother at the end of Copenhagen Marathon was big.
Yeah, I bet. I mean, again, incredible time. I don't think I'd ever see myself getting anywhere near that. So, do you think running has become more accessible than ever before?
Definitely. I think, it's more inclusive now. It's a thing where it's not a runner's body anymore. If you run, you're a runner. And I think that is amazing. I still think there's a few barriers to entry, like for women, especially in schools. I think not many girls enjoy sport at school, but like all boys love sport at school.
True.
And the way the media shows women in sport is so different to the way it shows men in sport.
Yeah.
So there's definitely work to do, but it definitely is more inclusive. Like my parents are running and they would never have ran before I was born.
Okay.
And the rise of like run clubs and communities.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've met my boyfriend through running, jobs running, and people are definitely training it for nights out.
Yeah. So what are your thoughts on running clubs?
So
you think they're good, great for finding friends. Like you said, you found your partner there.
Yeah.
Which is pretty cool.
Yeah, they
are community-based.
And I think London running community is very special. I think it's so diverse. There's so much culture there. It's like so passionate, and you can see all the different running clubs along the side of London Marathon, along the embankment. You can spot them all, and it's amazing. But yeah, I think some of them are too fast for some girls, so there's still work to be done. But I think if you know what you want, you can probably find that in a run club in London.
Okay, well, I mean, I'm sure there's lots and lots of options. So, I mean, is there an app? How do you think people, how do people find them?
I know some people are like trying to develop an app, but
great business idea, by the way.
To find your run club. But yeah, I think you just need to follow the people on social media. I think social media has been great to like promote that. But there are like run clubs, which are more social, and then there are running clubs, which are like England Athletics registered. So I'm part of Clapham Chasers, which is more elite training.
Okay.
Whereas some running clubs are just like a casual 5K. So there, I train for my harder sessions with Clapham, like track sessions, tempo sessions, and I think training with others and training with people faster really is what's transformed my running.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah, I mean, you train with, if you've got a harder surrounding, then you're going to do better, aren't you?
Yeah.
Right, so it's London Marathon this weekend. What are your top tips for running a marathon?
Okay, for the training, consistency really is key, and I know everybody says that, but if you're not being consistent, I would take a step back, look at why, and say you're missing sessions, you're not doing the mileage you want to do, whatever. Take a step back and make it easier, and then you'll get on this like momentum, and you'll be able to increase it like week by week, and soon enough you'll be where you want to be. And you know, that positive reinforcement of you're doing well will help you take two steps forwards rather than always taking two steps back when you feel disheartened. And then for the marathon this weekend, fueling's really important. Make sure you fuel and drink water before you get dehydrated or depleted. They're in cycling at the moment. It's who can take on the most carbs. Like, that's who wins. Obviously, don't do that if you haven't practiced, but, like, do what you've been doing in training, and then it's definitely going to get tough, and you need to have those mantras ready for you for what you're going to do when it gets tough and how you're going to push through that wall.
Amazing. Well, Anya, thank you so much for your time. Where can people find you on social media?
Just my Instagram, which is a.culling. Yeah.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much for your time. Good luck from us here. And thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Right, guys, coming up after this, I'll be joined by Nikki Lloyd-Graham, stress management consultant.
FUBAR Radio.
Death, a funny business on FUBAR Radio with Becky Briggs and Natasha Spencer-Levy.
The lovely Matt Phipps.
Hello.
The thing that surprised me most was how much joy I took in being, like, making people feel really uncomfortable. It's so
Amen.
Good. So good.
Your mum jokes change completely.
My friend the other day, she was like, how tall is your mum? And I was like, oh, she's 6 feet under. Yeah, they did not know what to do with that. Yeah. And then you let it hang in the air.
Yeah.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio. Download our app now to listen to your favourite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored, and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all FUBAR shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app. Just search for FUBAR Radio on the Apple and Google App Stores. Yay! The FUBAR Radio app. Get it today. Get it today.
Some companies try to reel people in by promising quick cash if you pay them to claim work expenses. But think twice before taking the bait, because they might just want to land a commission, and it turns out you aren't eligible to claim anything. You'll have to pay HMRC back, and it's unlikely the company will refund any fees. So don't get caught out. Check if you're eligible and make a claim with HMRC for free online. Just search Don't Get Caught Out.
One in five people in the UK are disabled, and it's not always visible. So if we've made ourselves at home in priority spaces on the bus or train, surrounded by our shopping bags or bikes, we could be making it harder for the people who need that space more than us. So let's not forget about the people we share our journeys with, and keep priority spaces clear for others. Remember, it's everyone's journey.
Politics Uncensored.
We kind of act like COVID didn't happen. Well, do you think it's had a lasting impact, at least on that young generation that experienced it?
The legacy of it in schools, you see the legacy of it in people's mental health. We're seeing the legacy of it even in public services, even in hotels, hospitality. Everything was stripped back to the bone, and the UK did not have the resilience to recover. So I think we are still definitely living in a post-COVID society where nothing really works as well as it did. If you think things were damaged by Brexit, things were double damaged by COVID.
Pulse of the Nation with Andrew White on FUBAR Radio.
Danny Harmer, hello.
Thank you, what an introduction.
I heard in an interview, this may no longer be the case, but in 2020 you said you'd never actually read the original Tracy Beaker.
I've still never read it, and I'm gonna go down with this ship, and quite frankly I shall never read it. I've got this far in life. And do you know what? I think it's kind of, in a weird way, I think it helped me get the part, because I had no idea of this character apart from the character that I made her.
Keeping fitness fun. What the Health with Georges Bertineau.
This is What the Health on FUBAR Radio with me, Georges Bertineau. Joining me now is Nikki Lloyd-Graham, who is a stress management consultant. Nikki, hello, how are you?
Hello, I'm good, thank you. Nice to be here.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining us. How have you been today?
Really good, thank you. Really, really good. Just recovering from a cold, so I'm actually pleased I've got a voice today to talk to you, because I've been struggling before though.
You've timed that one perfectly, so well done. Yeah, otherwise you'd have been maybe a little bit too stressed and a little bit, you would have had a sore throat.
No, I'd have still done it. It'd have just been with a bit of a husky voice.
Ah, okay, gotcha. Right, so let's dive straight into the questions. Why do you think stress is so prevalent in our everyday lives?
Two reasons. One, I think a lot of people don't understand what stress is, and therefore they don't take action in order to kind of manage their stress levels. And two, we are just overstimulated. When you understand what stress is, you realize, you know, even just sort of 30, 40, 50 years ago, we had time to decompress and de-stress and get rid of stress hormones and all that kind of stuff. These days, we don't give ourselves that time and space to do it. And of course, we're constantly subjected by narratives and messages and media and things that are contributing to our stress levels.
Yeah. So you think, obviously, the way the world has kind of shaped itself, whereas before we had a lot more time to ourselves, you know, maybe businesses didn't expect so much from us, or when we were self-employed, we didn't have to maybe push ourselves as much because, you know, cost of living wasn't as high and, you know, we weren't bombarded with adverts. The second we talk about something, our phones are listening and then we're like, oh, look, blue Adidas sliders. It's like, why are they popping up? So it's like we're overstimulated, right?
Yes, yeah. And we're overstimulated by a lot of things that our brain perceives as a threat.
Okay.
You know, we watch, you know, headlines and news and all those kind of things. And, you know, I quite often describe the stress response as a bit like a smoke alarm or an emergency alarm.
Yes.
And so we perceive, the key word is perceive, a threat. And so it goes off and we get stress hormones in our system. But we don't wait to check to see if there's a fire. We just think, you know, there might be. So, you know, you can read a headline, you can hear a loud noise, your phone can vibrate from a notification. And if you're waiting for a text that might be bad news.
Okay, yeah.
All of those things contribute and you get the stress hormones going into your system and your body thinks, you know.
Panic. And, yeah.
Panic. And that was only ever meant as an emergency solution. It wasn't meant to be, you know, pressed, if you like, or triggered
all day, every day, all the time. Yeah. Okay. And it's kind of like a marketing ploy, really, isn't it? It's like people as well, like, do you think that, you know, people see these headlines and they're like, oh my god, what's going, and then they want to read more or they want to find out more, and it's kind of used as, you know, it's negative, really. We're getting negative, you know, stress release.
I mean, I don't even think it's conscious that we think, I want to know more. I think it's our stress response. Our brain is there to protect us. It's all about survival. It's all about protecting. And in order to protect us, it has to predict. So therefore, it wants information. So if it sees a terrifying headline, it's like, oh, I need to make sure that I don't need to do anything to protect you from whatever this headline is. So I need more information.
Right. Okay. Interesting. I mean, yeah, I mean, this is fascinating stuff, because for me, I find that there's so many, like, I speak with lots of clients who are stressed and they're like, oh, why have the scales gone up? And it's like, well, you know, stress can heavily affect like water retention and stuff like that. So this is going to lead me on to obviously what I want to ask, but what impact does excess stress have on our physical and our mental health?
Okay, how long is this segment?
maybe the shorter version, because I know that this is a big question.
Yeah. I mean, cortisol and adrenaline are our main stress hormones, and if we use them in the right way, stress does help us. It's great, it's perfect, and it will have no long standing effects. But when we overuse it, we get problems, because part of the stress response to start off with, it uses the glucose in your bloodstream. So that means other areas of your body can't have that access to that. So things like your digestive system gets impacted. So lots of problems like IBS and things, you know, general digestive systems. Your immune system gets impacted, because, again, it will deal with emergency stuff, but it can't do the kind of background maintenance stuff as it's going on. long-term use will start to impact. I mean, literally, there's so many symptoms that are connected to it. It might be, you know, the moisture in your skin. So you might get dry skin. You might get lots of headaches because we tense. Part of the stress response is to get your muscles ready in case you need to engage fight or flight. Your muscles are ready for 8, 10, 12 hours a day. You're going to ache. Mm-hmm. And then that can lead to tension headaches and... I mean, there's a whole array of physical symptoms, but then you go on to the cognitive and the mental symptoms because it also impacts that. Mm-hmm. Your emergency response is meant to deal with emergencies. And so therefore it kind of takes the logical part of your brain, if you like, offline temporarily, because it's like, no, we're just dealing with, we need to get through the next minute. We need to get through the next minute. And so it affects your cognitive ability to make complex decisions, to even kind of view things with a more positive way, you know, with a more positive, through a more positive lens. We're just dealing with, where's the emergency, where's the threat, I need to look at that. It affects your ability to regulate emotion. It affects your ability to recall things and remember things. There's so many different impacts of what I would refer to as chronic stress rather than stress that we kind of need, because we should experience that stress response daily, and we do.
Yeah, but not always in the way that we should, because of, like we said, all the other variables. Okay, so you mentioned chronic stress. Like, I'm assuming that everything you mentioned is exactly how chronic stress affects us.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
And but it doesn't affect everyone in the same way. Like, some people will react differently. Some people might not get the headaches, but they get terrible stomach problems. Or some people might just be really, really irritable and in a bad mood. Some people won't be able to sleep. In fact, most people won't be able to sleep, to be fair. So there is no order it happens either. Like, some people will get hit with one thing first.
Okay.
And if you've already got a vulnerability, say, for example, I don't know, you suffer with eczema or...
It will amplify it.
Yeah, it will exacerbate that, and you're more likely to trigger an episode of whatever vulnerability you already have.
Okay, so basically understanding how your body responds to stress is super important, because obviously there's different levels to stress, like we said.
Yeah, it's almost like a sliding scale individually, and I think if you can recognize your own early warning signs, you can take action at that point instead of pushing through and powering through, which is what most of us do. Take action at that point, and then you start to almost build your resilience and your ability to cope with any other stressful things that come in. The irony is, when you're in that chronic stress state, you're not, even though the stress response is supposed to help you overcome major things, because you can't almost like tap into the right parts of your brain at that point, it's like going on kind of, you know, standby mode.
Okay, yeah.
So you can only do the very basics, whereas if you can manage to certainly physically bring your stress response down, you can then engage the right parts of your brain to help you deal with things better.
Okay. Okay. Well, so would you say that there's misconceptions around stress that, you know, you'd maybe like to put straight? Because for me, from what you've just said, I was thinking like, oh, well, you know, if I was super stressed, I'll just go to the gym, or I'll go for a walk, or, you know, I'll have some food. But then sometimes those things don't help, or maybe they do help.
So there's a lot of myths around stress, and that stress has got a really bad reputation. Like, you mentioned the word stress and people go, oh no, it's horrible.
Yeah.
When it's used in the right way, I quite often refer to it as your internal superhero.
Okay.
It can help you do things, and you will have done this.
Productivity, you know, and stuff like that.
A deadline, like if you're a parent, how many times have you stopped your kid falling over or whatever else, and you've moved really fast? You know, you can walk across the road, a car comes speeding around the corner, you become an Olympic sprinter for 5 yards and you don't injure yourself. The stress response works really well when we need it. The stress response is actually what helps us wake up in the morning, and it should take a natural decline throughout the day unless we need it, you know, for an emergency.
Yeah.
But the problem we have, I think, nowadays is, again, we don't get respite from it. We used to. We don't anymore. And so your body doesn't have time to get rid of those excess cortisol and adrenaline hormones and norepinephrine and all the other stuff that gets released. And so we're on a constant loop. And actually, yeah, doing things like the gym can really help if that's your thing.
Yeah.
For some people, the gym might be a stressor.
Yes. Yes, busy gyms, they don't like going. Yes, of course.
Yeah. It just depends on what your thing is. It's about identifying what is it that makes you feel good, that introduces maybe happier hormones into your system that help cortisol released, that cause you to, you know, breathe in a certain way so that your body releases and it recognizes it's safe. That, you know, that everyone has different ways, but we need to, the first thing that normally happens when we've got loads of stuff on is we focus on the things that we've got on and we constantly just keep pressing this emergency button, if you like. Whereas if we just spent, you know, if we said, right, we're really, really busy, I've got a really big deadline, so this morning I'm going to go, as an example, for a good walk to start the day so that I start in a good place.
Yes.
Even though your brain's saying, I haven't got time, actually, by doing that, you put your brain in a better place to be able to deal with everything much more efficiently.
Okay. Yeah, okay. So why did you decide to set up the stress specialist?
Because of my own stress journey. I actually had a breakdown in 2013. Mm-hmm. Lots of contributing factors, the main one being work. And kind of when I went to get help with it, it was a bit hit and miss. And I recognised that if I knew then what I knew now, I wouldn't have got to that point. Okay. I mean, I had quite a serious breakdown. Unfortunately, a friend ended up having to take me into hospital. It was, you know, quite a scary time. Mm-hmm. And it was like, God, if I'd have just known then what I know now, I wouldn't have had to go through this. And I would have, you know, I would have paid attention. When the doctor did say to me, take some time off, I would have taken time off.
Yeah.
You know, when, you know, the doctors were saying prioritize sleep and all this kind of stuff, I would have done that, but I didn't at the time. And I noticed there was a big lack of knowledge and education about it. So basically, I left my work and I retrained, and that kind of started the stress specialist journey.
Amazing.
Just because I think the more people know about this, the more realize how much agency they've got.
Yes.
Manage it. It's not, you know, you have so much control over this, but we don't realize because we don't know.
No, of course, and education is key and knowledge is power, right? And I think we are all our own worst enemies sometimes. It's just like, oh, I'll be all right. I'll be okay. You know, tomorrow I'll feel better. And sometimes we do, but it's the accumulation of the bad days that get on top of you. And then, like, you know, like your situation, you had a bad episode or you had a bad time. But then you've done something good with it. And I'm not saying other people haven't, but I'm saying you've thought, oh, there's actually a gap here where I can help others like myself, and you've gone forwards with it. So, you know, that kind of leads me on to my last question. Do you have any top tips for managing stress?
The one thing that I generally say to people is most people make the mistake of, say, you're going to write down everything that's causing you stress. You'd write all that down, and if you think about it, your thoughts throughout any given day are probably on those things that are causing you stress. Mm-hmm. And you've probably sacrificed, you know, sleep, drinking water. I see you just about to take a drink of water. You sacrifice your foundations and you sacrifice the things that actually help you.
Yeah.
So basically create, for want of a better expression, a feel-good list, things that really help you. And then whenever, you know, and identify your own early warning signs. Whenever you know there's a lot of things on your list, I mean, I quite often use the stress bucket analogy. When there's a lot of things in your bucket, you need to do things to put holes in the bucket. So yes. Whether that's, you know, sitting and having 5 minutes with a cup of tea or going for a walk or booking a holiday or, you know, having a hug with a loved one, whatever it might be. But we need to kind of be proactive rather than reactive. So in the same way we brush our teeth every day, just make sure every single day you're doing something that will actively drop your cortisol levels. And that will be whatever works for you. Listening to music, you know, whatever it might be.
Okay. Right. Well, I mean, Nikki, thank you so much for everything today. Where can people find you online? Do you have social media, maybe a website?
Yeah. So I have the website, thestressspecialist.com, and you can find me under The Stress Specialist on Instagram and Facebook.
Perfect. So. Thank you so much for your time. You have a great rest of your week and great rest of your day. And I'll speak to you soon.
All right. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much. Take care. Bye-bye. Right, guys, now it's time to answer some of your fitness questions. If you want to get involved, you can DM us at What the Health Show on Instagram. Kyle asks, does eating a healthy diet alone help reduce weight, or do I have to exercise as well? Well, technically, all you have to do, Kyle, is a calorie deficit. Now, if that's not easy for you, then if you incorporate a little bit of walking and a little bit of gym, that's going to help you make a bigger gap. So you need about 3,500 calories out of your weekly maintenance to decrease a pound of fat. So that's 7,000 for 2 pounds of fat. So if you think about it this way, if you have a 500 calorie deficit over 7 days, that's 3,500 calories. And then you do a little bit of extra walking, and then you do a little bit more gym, all of a sudden you've made quite a hefty dent in this, you know, calorie deficit pool. So yes, you can reduce weight and lose fat via, you know, a healthy diet. Right, guys, so I just want to say a massive thank you for our guests. A massive thank you to Giles, Anya, and Nikki for joining us today on What the Health. Just a little reminder, you can download the app and listen each week. You can follow us on social media. We are at What the Health on Instagram. Also, if you want help with your health and fitness goals, I provide a top tier coaching service, which is no BS problem solving, and I also hold your hand every step of the way. If this is of interest to you, please reach out at gb.fitness.health. Also, the show will be available to listen back to on all good podcasting platforms. Just a massive thank you from me. I'm back next week at 11 a.m. Thank you. Goodbye.